broadcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, July 16th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time and from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and PRN.FM.
You're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. We've got a fantastic show for you today that's going to include how iron supplements, which seem so simple, can reduce fatigue but have a double-edged sword.
And a nutrient cocktail to treat Alzheimer's.
And what would you think if some surgical resident who was tired was doing your surgery?
And what we believe influences our health.
And a whole lot more, so stay tuned.
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific Time or 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
All right, so what's new in the news, Vicki?
One of the major complaints that patients have when they go to visit the doctor, as you know, is fatigue. Now, there's a lot of reasons why people can be tired besides not getting enough sleep, or having chronic fatigue syndrome, or fibromyalgia, or multiple chemical sensitivities. They can have lung disease, heart disease, and many, many other diseases. They can have drug side effects. They can be tired from depression. And most of us know that fatigue is a major symptom of anemia, and supplementing with iron helps the fatigue. But here's a Canadian study showing that iron supplements can reduce fatigue 50% in non-anemic women with low iron levels. So how can a woman have low iron and not be anemic? What's the definition of anemia?
Well, first of all, there's a little buffer zone between having a problem with less hemoglobin and less oxygen carrying capacity and less red cells. There's a difference between that and feeling fatigue. We feel fatigue when we don't make enough energy. We just don't have enough ATP, that energy currency. It's like gasoline runs a car, ATP runs ourselves. We don't have enough of that, we get tired. And what's shocking about this article, at least to me, is that there's so many causes of fatigue. This Vicki mentioned some of them, but it's innumerable. And we see so many patients who come in with fatigue that it takes a little experience to know when to find what cause or how to explore which particular factor is leading to it. And now we found that if your iron count is on the low side of normal, just barely below the low side of normal, you haven't yet lost your ability to carry enough oxygen, but there's still fatigue. And in this particular study, they showed that, as Vicki said, 50%, there was a 50% reduction in fatigue in people who had this particular situation. So what's anemia? It's when you aren't able to carry enough oxygen to your tissues because you don't have enough red cells, you don't have enough hemoglobin. And to the surprise of a lot of people, in this particular study, where they looked at 200 women who had low iron content in their blood as measured by something called a ferritin level, it was below a level of 50, and you'd like to see it above 50. When they treated them with just low-dose iron for 12 weeks, the fatigue that they had decreased by 50%. Big numbers that really kind of surprised me when I saw it, and of course will alert me to that possibility in the future. So this didn't turn out to be anxiety or depression. It actually showed that blood counts and iron levels rose when they gave a little bit of iron. So that's an interesting story.
So this is a good thing for doctors to be aware of. So I've heard, too, that too much iron can be dangerous. So what's the relationship between cancer and microbes and iron?
Well, it's not just that, and I'll get to that in a second, but people who have a disease called hemochromatosis means that they have iron storage above normal levels. And you might think, well, I never even heard of the disease. Why are you even telling me about it? Well, 5% of the population has the recessive gene for this. Maybe it's a bit more. So it's extremely common. And so if you're adding iron to the body and it doesn't need it, and you have too much, you're going to cause a reaction called the Fenton reaction, where you have iron reacting with oxygen and producing something called a hydroxyl radical, which is the most powerful free radical in the human body. It causes premature aging, cancer, it can promote infection, as Vicky was suggesting. We know that infected bacteria require iron for them to be able to grow. We know cancer cells require iron for them to be able to grow. And if we take iron in those settings and our levels are relatively normal, we're going to be putting kerosene on the fire that makes the infection worse and the cancer spread or grow faster.
Yeah, boy, if you have cancer, many times you have a lowered immune system, especially if you've had chemo.
For
sure. And then if you took iron supplements, that would be not a good thing.
No. So if you're in the hospital and you've got a problem with an infection or you've got cancer and your blood count is normal, you sure as heck don't want to be taking a multivitamin with iron or cooking with an iron skillet, okay, or anything like that, because it's going to cause iron levels to rise. That's going to make the cancer grow, make the infection worse, and put you at risk for more free radical damage. It ages you too fast.
So the main thing here, it sounds like, is we need balance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a good idea for women to just be buying iron over the counter, because you can buy it over the counter,
mm-hmm.
before having a lab test done that shows what your iron level is, and let your healthcare practitioner direct you as to whether or not you need to take iron supplements or not. There are other ways you can get iron besides supplements in an iron skillet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if you eat organic calf's liver, mm-hmm. probably any kind of meat,
yeah,
and
good.
Spinach and mm-hmm. greens, you can get iron that way.
Yeah, it's a good way to
but
do that.
But you don't want to overdo the iron, and you don't want to not have enough. So.
Well, it's like baby bear's porridge. It's got to be just right. Too much, no good. Too little, no good. It's particularly important in women who are pregnant. You have too little iron, which most women who are menstruating, of course, they'd have to be to get pregnant in the first place. If they don't have enough iron, the problem you run into there is fetal brain development. There just isn't much. So it's really important that we have just the right amount and we have this balance. So we think of iron, we don't think much of it. The balance is different in men and women, and it's different in the age that a woman is at. You don't have enough in infancy, you have mental retardation. You don't have enough as a menstruating woman, you're going to be anemic and fatigued. If you're older and beyond menopause, you have the risk of developing too much iron, because your body is good at absorbing it because it's been practicing for all these years, and here we are.
So if you have any questions about your health or you'd like to just join in on this topic, what's our phone number here?
888-874-4888, so give us a call.
MIT's come up with a nutrient cocktail to improve memory in early Alzheimer's disease by helping us to overcome the loss of connections between brain cells, also known as synapses. So do we know the cause of this dreaded Alzheimer's disease?
Well, we've got lots of theories about it, and we know a lot about it, and we know many aspects of what Alzheimer's disease is and how it works and why we have problems with our memory and our ability to think and to do the things we normally do. I mean, we're talking about beta amyloid a lot of the time, which is a toxic protein, which is very bad for the brain. We're talking about neurofibrillatory tangles. They're called tau products that show that there's damage to the brain. We know there are genetic causes. That APOE4 gene that everybody's talking about is certainly something that could have a lot to do with putting us at risk for it.
And what about flu shots?
Absolutely.
Those contain mercury and aluminum. We all know that aluminum can increase our risk of Alzheimer's.
Well, a famous immunologist, Hugh Feudenberg, who's published probably a couple thousand papers over his lifespan, studied this. And when I had a personal communication with him years ago, he said that if you took just four flu shots over one decade, over 10 years, that your risk for Alzheimer's disease was up at least 25%. So wow. You're looking at a number here that's huge. And we think of what we're doing to our kids with these immunizations at you know, as youngsters. You can be getting 80 or 90 immunizations by the time you're 18 years old. That's just insanity, particularly when you think of all the mercury.
And then also when you go to the pharmacy, you see all these old people standing in line to get their flu shot.
Oh, yeah, here, come and get a little dose of Alzheimer's disease or something like it. And what about sugar? We know sugar causes inflammation in the body, which is going to cause Alzheimer's disease to be worse. And it also can poison proteins. A process called glycation occurs, particularly in diabetics, when blood sugar levels get above about 170.
We're also always talking about vitamin D. Does this have anything to do with our memory?
Well, it does. I mean, if you look at people who are living in rest homes, they don't get out in the sun that much. You have to keep in mind that UVB rays don't go through the glass windows that are there. And we have to get some sunlight or else we're not going to get any vitamin D unless we supplement. So the problem here is that unless we do something to take vitamin D, our level is going to be dangerously low, particularly in that setting. And I found there's plenty of research showing that if you take these people, measure their vitamin D levels and find out they're really low, what happens is if you give them vitamin D, a lot of them, they start thinking clearer. They lose a lot of the dementia that they have. Their muscles become stronger. There's less pain. And some of them are getting out of their wheelchairs and out of the rest homes. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We've got some calls waiting, and we'll get right back to them after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
Well, the men are going to love this one, and the ladies, please have a sense of humor. Here's the title in this brochure that we just got, Men Teaching Classes for Women at the Adult Learning Center.
Oh, that sounds like trouble right from the start.
Registration must be completed by July 29th. 2012. Okay. And note, due to the complexity and the difficulty level of their contents, class sizes will be limited to 8 participants maximum.
Okay.
So, class 1, up in winter, down in summer.
What?
How to adjust a thermostat.
Oh, there's a stellar course.
Step by step with a slide presentation. Class 2, which takes more energy? Putting the toilet seat down or bitching about it for 3 hours?
Well, I know what the price is if you don't put it down.
They're gonna
That's not worth it.
They're going to have a roundtable discussion.
And then second, fun either.
Is it possible to drive past a Walmart without stopping? Group debate. Well, that one's not my problem.
No. Wish that was your problem. Something about Saks that I don't think is the greatest place.
Oh, get out of here. I've never been to Saks.
I see. There's a line. You've never been to Saks.
Well, I never bought anything.
Oh, now we're changing it a little. What's on order?
Fundamental differences between a purse and a suitcase.
That's true.
Pictures and explanatory graphics. Okay, class 5, curling irons. Can they levitate and fly into the bathroom cabinet? Examples on a video.
Oh, that's
I don't know how they do that on a video.
Yeah, well.
How to ask questions during commercials and be quiet during the program.
Mm.
They also have a helpline support and support groups. Class 7, can a bath be taken without 14 different kinds of soaps and shampoos? Open forum. Well, they better have me come to that one because I can tell them about healthy products.
Yes, you can.
Class 8, Health Watch. They make medicine for PMS. Use it.
Yeah, indeed. Please.
I was wrong and he was right.
Mm.
Real-life testimonials. And class 10, how to parallel park in less than 20 minutes without an insurance claim.
Oh.
And they'll have driving simulations. Class 11, learn to live, how to apply brakes without throwing passengers through the windshield. And class 12, how to shop by yourself. Well, I don't need that one.
No.
I prefer to shop by myself.
Well,
than
we've
have
worked
you complain.
Through this. Well, I get tired of sitting in that big chair, you know, where you sleep while you try on 4 different sizes and shapes and et cetera.
I don't try on 4 different sizes.
You don't?
That's right. You're sleeping in the chair.
Yeah, well, I guess that's my imagination. Well, that's really cool, Vicki. Thank you. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from Dorothy from South Carolina. Hi, Dorothy.
Hey, how are you?
Fine.
I guess, really, if I could get the other person to call, that would be fine, but they don't have Internet, so I'm calling for them.
Okay.
I have about the iron. I have two opposite questions. My next-door neighbor, who's almost 88, has trouble keeping her iron levels up, even though she eats beef liver.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if you have some general insights on that, what might be going on or might not be going on.
Yep.
Then I have a friend
with
the opposite problem, but go ahead.
Oh, we'll do the first one first.
Okay.
Take a little vitamin C, and that'll help stimulate the absorption of iron.
I know she knows that one.
Okay. And the other thing is, does she take any drugs?
She takes supposedly a low-dose blood pressure medicine and a baby aspirin.
Okay, well, she may be losing blood because of the aspirin, the baby
aspirin.
Yeah,
well, somebody did, she had some doctor do, you know, look down in her stomach and didn't see any bleeding and stuff like that, but I'm still suspicious.
Well, if they did something to look down her stomach, there must have been something going on in her stomach, because they wouldn't
well,
do
yeah,
that.
Well, yeah, they were looking down, well, she was having a lot of, she at that time was having some diarrhea,
okay,
and they also
so.
Did a colonoscopy. That's what they did. That's
all
what
right.
it was.
Well, Dorothy, here's another thing that could be. She may be, well be taking something for indigestion, and a lot of those drugs, those purple pills, they
no,
block the absorption. You're sure of it?
Well,
no, I wouldn't be so sure,
okay.
Because a lot of the time what happens is in that setting, if you have digestive problems that lead to an upper GI endoscopy, doctors will almost regularly, almost without exception, put you on the purple pill, which blocks the absorption of iron.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to really keep in mind.
Okay.
So I would get off the aspirin if there's any way to do it, keeping in mind that I am not her doctor and I'm not giving you advice.
Many people take fish oil instead.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I know she takes that. Okay.
Well, that may be a much better way to go. So we need to know why she's taking aspirin. If it's to prevent a heart attack at age 88, I got my doubts about that one.
Yeah, I do too. I do. Well, some doctor told her to take it.
Well,
either
you've given me three areas here to give you advice on.
Yeah, there
she
you
could
go.
Even have bled for, she could have even bled from the colonoscopy.
Right. That happens, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I hope that helps you, Dorothy. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, but there's a second question.
Oh, all right. Go for that.
Well, I have another neighbor down the street who has the opposite problem. You were talking about 5% of the people. He has to go blood lead every so often because of his iron levels, and he's on disability. I don't know what all is wrong with him, but what are some of your – I don't know what all he's doing. So anyway, what are some of your insights on that? And he can always call. I mean, he can always listen. Maybe he can come over here and listen.
Well, he can go to the website. Okay,
yeah.
You can take him to the website at drsaputo.com and put in iron, and you'll find a lot of things coming up, or put in hemochromatosis, if you can remember that, in the search box, and lots of things will come up that talk about that. But there are no other ways to deal with hemochromatosis that make any sense except for bloodletting, because there's no other way to get rid of iron, because iron is concentrated really in our red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
So getting red blood cells out of the body is the answer to that. And then there are lots of ways to measure how much.
Mm-hmm.
We generally follow something called the ferritin level, and that tells you how much iron storage you have in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that helps you.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Yep.
All right, you have a good day too, Dorothy. Nice to talk to you. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, you know, we weren't really finished with the Alzheimer's disease, because there are other causes for Alzheimer's disease besides the flu shots and the vitamin D and the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
How about not enough antioxidants, things like vitamin C and vitamin E?
Well, that's right. We there's a lot of data showing that people who take vitamin E have a much less high risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. And if we don't have antioxidants, enough that we get from food and in the right balance, it doesn't mean just go out and take 10 grams of vitamin C every day. I mean, it's you're listening to a symphony here when you're looking at antioxidant balance. And you wouldn't want to put 1,000 bass drums in your symphony. You'd like to have a very delicate balance. Again, it's like baby bear's porridge. You need a little of this, a little of that, a little of something else, so it balances just right. And that's what you get from something called food. So eat foods that are high in those elements so that you get enough of it.
So also, what about the drugs we see advertised on TV and in the magazines, like these acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, like Aricept and Exelon and Rozad?
Yeah, well, see, these are close to a waste of time. They'll put you at risk for the side effects. They will not improve your symptoms hardly at all, and maybe a minor amount, 5 or 10% maybe. And then you have the problem of looking at ulcers and headaches and seizures and insomnia, difficulty sleeping, being tired. Not a good scenario.
So what we started out to talk about were nutritional approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really getting low on time again because it's about time for the station break. So maybe we're going to have to get to some of these
let's approaches
for Alzheimer's disease.
Let's do it quickly. We're looking at one study done at MIT, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, that talked about promoting the connections, the synapses in brain cells, because that's one of the things that's lost when people develop Alzheimer's disease. We just don't have enough connections. And here, what they did is they used a combination of choline, which makes acetylcholine, uridine, and DHA, which are things that are important at keeping our connections growing. And what they found is about 40% of 300 people who had mild Alzheimer's disease who used this combination of supplements improved their memory substantially by about 40%.
And when we come back, we're going to tell you how you can get these things out of food and also what some other nutritional approaches are
all right,
for Alzheimer's disease.
All right. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls and finishing this discussion after a short station break. Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, we were talking about MIT's nutrient cocktail that includes uridine, choline, and DHA for Alzheimer's disease, and it actually improved the Alzheimer's disease by 40%. But what I wanted to let you know is where you can find these nutrients. Like, where can you find choline?
Well, then what kind of foods you mean?
Yeah, like meat,
yeah,
nuts,
right.
Eggs, that kind of thing. And then DHA, that's an omega-3 fatty acid.
It's found in fish oil, and it can be found in flax oil and other things like that.
And also in eggs,
mm-hmm.
And some grass-fed animals. But what about the uridine? What's uridine and
well,
how do you get that?
It's part of what nucleic acids are made of. That's what our DNA is made of. And you get that in most meats, but things like sweetbreads and liver and pancreas are high in purines.
So then maybe you might want to take a supplement of uridine, maybe.
You might.
If you don't want to be eating liver
and
kidney.
Well, they're making a product, okay? This company is making a product, and they're talking about packaging uridine, choline, and DHA together. But there are many other things you could use as well. Niacinamide is another one. It's not niacin. It's a form of it. So it's a form of vitamin B3 that's very important in making energy in the body. So we need niacinamide to do that. And then there's coconut oil, which is very interesting stuff. It's a saturated fat that a lot of people feel is one that's not good for the body. But these people who feel that way just don't know much about coconut oil because it's tremendous. And if you get good, high-quality coconut oil, that's really important. Don't get the cheap stuff.
Organic, too.
Organic, too, because it's liable to have aflatoxin in it if the coconuts are old and get moldy. So good coconut oil provides another energy source. And, of course, in Alzheimer's disease, part of what happens is like an electrical brownout. So what happens is that you have a lack of energy production. It's like in the summertime when everybody's using their air conditioner and there's just not enough power to run them all. Things just fall apart. Well, the brain is the same way. So if you have that as a problem, coconut oil provides an alternate source of energy that the brain can use. It makes ketone bodies. And you would think that's not good because it's something that in diabetes can cause ketoacidosis and can be fatal. But this doesn't cause that in normal people. In fact, it doesn't cause it in diabetics either. It makes you have an energy source that the brain can use, and it actually picks up and solves this electrical brownout.
There are other supplements, too, that are helpful for Alzheimer's, like vitamin B12 and curcumin.
Well, B12, of course, if you don't have enough of, you're going to have neurological problems. And so I think that that's an issue. You need vitamin C and E for the antioxidants, and, of course, vitamin D, and all these things. If we use in conjunction with exercise, physical and mental exercise, your risk for getting Alzheimer's disease is really quite a bit lower. It looks like we have a call from Sharon from New Mexico on this topic of Alzheimer's. So, hi, Sharon. How are you doing? Sharon, are you on the line?
Yeah.
Ah, good. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. You have a question for us?
Yes, I have two. One of them is you mentioned that someone was going to be making this combination of the choline, uridine, and DHEA supplement.
Yes.
Do you know who that is?
Yes. It was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. And let's see.
MIT.
MIT, was, yeah, but you can't just go to MIT. There's a fellow named Richard Wortman. And I can give you, let's see, a name of someone you could contact at the MIT News office. If you Google that and put Ann Trafton in, and then put the name of this product in there, if I can find this.
Could you tell me her second name, T-R?
T-R-A-F-T-O-N. And it's available now, I think, in stores.
It's called S-O-U-V, like in Vicky, E-N-A-I-D, Suvinade.
Yeah, so if you put that actually in the Google search, you'll do better.
It's a beverage.
Oh, it's a beverage. Okay, wonderful.
So you could do it that way, or you could just get your own choline, uridine, and DHA.
Okay. But the ratios matter, don't they?
Yeah, they probably do. And you can look Sylvanoid up and then do the action that you want.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling, Sharon. Have a good day. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So this whole topic of Alzheimer's disease is one that we need to be more aggressive about, because there's a lot you can do if you'll take responsibility yourself. If you wait until things go wrong, it's too late, and it's your lifestyle that determines how well you're going to do. If you don't have a healthy lifestyle, I mean, the risk for everything going bad it goes up. So we need to make sure we're getting enough sleep and eat the right foods and get plenty of exercise and stimulate our brain and try to reduce our stress levels and weigh what we should and be engaged in things in life that keep us busy. All those things are the things that keep us well. It's not the waiting for drugs from some pharmaceutical company to bail you out or bail you into trouble. I mean, if you want to really learn about this, look at Gary Null's video, Death by Medicines. Fantastic job he did on that. And you won't be thinking about things like the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors like Aricept or the drugs that are the NMDA inhibitors like Namenda. These are things that we tend to assume are going to be useful for us and are going to bail us out of trouble. But then there are all the side effects and the complications, and by the time you're through with all the research, it's not that good. So we need to do what makes sense to keep us healthy. So a healthy lifestyle, for no matter what you have, is the first thing you turn to. And it doesn't mean it's the only thing. There may be a lot of other things to do in addition, depending on what it is. Well, it's time for it's time for Vicki's 2020 tip. And after her 2020 tip, we'll come back with more of your calls at 888-874-4888.
I have some observations on growing older. Realize that today is the oldest that you've ever been.
Oh, jeez.
Yet, it's the youngest that you'll ever be.
Oh, don't make me sad.
So enjoy this day while it lasts.
Okay.
Even if it's not your birthday.
That's right.
Going out, what some more observations on getting older. Going out is good. Coming home is better.
Earlier, for more sleep.
You forget names, but it's okay because other people forgot they even knew you.
Indeed.
Now, the things you used to care to do, you no longer care to do, but you really do care that you don't care to do them anymore.
And some of them were fun, and you can't do them. That's right.
Also, you remember that one about I thought a thought, but the thought I thought wasn't the thought I thought I thought? If I thought the thought I thought I thought, I wouldn't have thought the thought I thought.
I'm getting a headache, Vicki. What do you...
You sleep better on a lounge chair with the TV blaring than in bed, and it's called pre-sleep.
Jeez.
You tend to use more four-letter words.
Indeed.
What? When? Now that you can afford expensive jewelry, it's not safe to wear it anymore. And you notice everything they sell in stores is sleeveless.
Of course.
What used to be freckles are now liver spots.
Mm.
Not so cute anymore.
Right.
And everybody whispers. You have three sizes of clothes in your closet, two of which you'll never wear. You know, when you think about all these things, it's not what you gather but what you scatter that tells what kind of life you have lived.
Isn't that an interesting way to look at it? I like that. Those are fun things to think about if you're not in the situation yourself. You know, as you get older, things definitely change. But I'll tell you, Vicki, I wouldn't want to be one day younger because I don't want to have to go through what I did yesterday or the day before to learn what I've already got. I've already done that. And it may be worth having a few physical limitations, but, you know, if you keep yourself healthy because you have a healthy lifestyle, you're going to go downhill a lot slower than if you don't.
Yep, and like we've been talking about for a while here, we don't want to get Alzheimer's disease.
Indeed.
Anyway, here's an outrageous article about whether to inform a patient having surgery if a trainee or a resident will perform the surgery. According to a study published in the July 2012 Archives of Surgery, only 25% of eye institutions have a policy to inform their patients that residents would be involved in their surgery.
That's
a very delicate
shocking
surgery. And I just had cataract surgery on my right eye last week, and I researched to find a well-qualified eye surgeon.
Well, I'll say.
Now, if I found out that a trainee was going to do it, I would have looked elsewhere.
Absolutely.
And I don't know how they're supposed to learn, but I don't want them to learn it on me.
Yeah, well, that's why, you know, there are a lot of doctors out there who do these surgeries that are incompetent, and they've had lots of experience. And then you take somebody who's in training, a resident, who's tired on top of it.
Yeah, no, we talked about this a few weeks ago, that they said it was like being drunk, that a lot of these residents average like about 5.5 hours of sleep, which is equivalent to being legally drunk 25% of the time.
Well,
and some of them only get 3 hours of sleep.
Can you imagine somebody doing an operation on you with 3 hours of sleep that's not well trained?
Well, I'll tell
somehow
you, I wouldn't want them operating on my eye. Or your, look at what happened with your hip. And you didn't even think to ask if a resident was going to do the surgery. You just assumed that the doctor was going to do the surgery.
Well, now I'm beginning to wonder because I know how it didn't turn out, and I went to a really well-qualified surgeon.
Because one of the things that this article brought out is that a lot of these programs don't inform the patients because they're afraid that the patient wouldn't want a resident to perform the surgery and they want them to learn.
Well, isn't that a shock? I mean, yeah, let's not think about what the patient wants or what the concern is for the patient. Let's just go ahead and do what's best for our hospital and our residents.
Yeah, also, I mean, it's not just your eyes. What about your heart? That's very delicate
or
surgery.
Your brain.
Or your brain,
or
yeah.
Or the vascular surgery.
Or back surgery.
Any surgery. Yeah, for sure. I mean, when you think
well,
of
some of them I might not mind. I mean, you don't call having a baby a surgery, really.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't want somebody who's had 2.5 hours of sleep delivering our baby. I just don't want that to happen. And when you look at...
But if the doctor's there, he could cover for a problem.
Yeah, what if he's not there? I remember when I was training at Highland Hospital, the general hospital in Oakland, we used to call the Knife and Gun Club.
About 50 years ago?
200 years ago, something like that. I delivered 125 babies. There wasn't anybody standing around me. I delivered those babies.
Really?
Absolutely.
I got to deliver one as a nurse. The doctor was right there, but I got to take it out.
The doctor wasn't there in the middle of the night. They knew we could kind of do it, and if something went wrong, it would have been a disaster probably. But out of 125 babies, I didn't have any problems. That was luck. I mean, when you are tired as we were and you're in that situation, it's awful. When you look at the fact that the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education has enacted new rules for first-year residents and say they can't work any more than 16 straight hours, I'm thinking, I sure don't want some resident who's been working for 15 hours to be doing my surgery. And then for senior residents, they're saying they're allowed to work 28 straight hours. That's insane.
Well, you know, when I had my eye surgery last week, I was the first one.
Yeah.
I got there. We were there at 6:30 in the morning. My surgery was supposed to be at 7.
Well, that's right, because even the best surgeons can have a bad time.
I want to be right when they're fresh and bushy-tailed, hopefully awake.
Well, the Institute of Medicine also looked at how much it would cost to institute the rules I just told you about, 16 hours for first-year residents and 28 hours for second-year residents. At the national level, it would be $1.7 billion more to replace the hours by other trained staff. Now, if they did something that was reasonable, it would be 2 to 3 times that. And that is what you're really looking at.
And I hear people brag about going to these teaching hospitals.
Oh, right. You've got to be insane.
Now, I mean, it's fine if you consent to it and if you want to do it and you want to assist these people in learning, but I think that full disclosure is the ethical thing to do. We have a right to know. And, you know, too, I was just thinking when I was saying that about wanting to be the first surgery, you were the same way when you had your hip done. You wanted to be early on the surgical schedule. I think you were the first one that day, too. But what if the resident was working with the doctor and you didn't know it, and that resident, it wasn't his first patient in the morning. It might have been you getting there and being the first one, but that resident, he or she, could have been working there all night and still working to do their complete their 16 or 28-hour shift.
That's exactly right. You know, when they did this study that was published in Archives of Ophthalmology, they sent 117 letters out to the directors of ophthalmological programs. 53 responded, which means an awful lot didn't. And only 14 of these programs inform patients about whether or not a resident might be involved with their surgery. And 7 of those hospitals insisted that the resident do the telling, and only 7 were told by the doctor. Now, that to me is dishonest, inappropriate. It's malpractice.
Well, also, the doctor that wrote the editorial said that the patient would know anyway because... for an eye surgery because they were kept awake. Well, I'll tell you, with my experience, I knew the doctor was in there because I heard him say his name and my name and which eye he was operating on and so forth, but I couldn't see him. I never saw him the whole time. And when you go into the room, there's an anesthesiologist, there's a nurse that's wrapping you up and everything. How do you know who the people are that are in the room? That's ridiculous to say the patient's going to know because they're awake.
That's for
sure. In fact, I don't even remember a lot of it. They give you 2 different kinds of sedatives, and one of them's an amnesia drug.
Right. They give you propofol and a little Versed.
I mean, that's a lame excuse.
Of course it is. I mean, I had a spinal anesthetic when I had my hip done. And I didn't know what was going on. I was totally out of it, too, because they don't want you awake. Because
they don't want you to be restless
well,
or
it's
moving around.
Well, I didn't really want to be awake either.
No.
Who wants to go through all that? But that's what happens, and you will go through that. But, I mean, the main thing here we're talking about is what's the responsibility? What's ethical?
How do they learn? On a cadaver.
Well, that's right. Maybe on a cadaver. Maybe they should be getting more sleep. Maybe we should be treating residents with a lot more respect in terms of the kinds of things that we expect from them. To be working 28 straight hours is not only bad for the patients, it's bad for the doctor. and it's starting to, it's sending a message to that doctor that says something about how much they're not valued in, because they're just working them to death. And obviously the big issue here again is money. I mean, that's what's causing all this to happen. I remember when I was an intern, and I was on for 36 hours and off for 12 for months at a time, and I can tell you what an impact that had on my life. I couldn't exercise. I couldn't be with my kids. There was no social life. There was a lot of stress involved. I was fatigued all the time. And, yeah, I'm complaining about it all these years later because it's not right. We should be treating our residents like they're wonderful, precious assets to our community, and teach them the value system that they should have if they want to try and take that kind of work ethic into their lives later on.
Sort of like a fraternity.
Well, it is,
you know,
in lots of ways.
Well, I've gone through it, so you should have to go through it too.
Well, that's right.
Part of the training.
Well,
of saying, let's improve it for the future.
Why do you think that doctors have the highest suicide rate and drug addiction rate and alcoholism? It's because of all this stress.
Well, this is a great combination.
Well, you know,
they're not getting enough sleep and they're drugged and alcoholic.
Well, it's about time somebody blew the whistle. You know, this whistleblowers with an S .org that
Gary was talking about
is absolutely right. And I want to be a founding member of that. I think it's a great organization.
Now,
you should tune into his show tonight.
We're not saying that all doctors are this way.
Of course not.
But
this is what happens, and it's what's encouraged, and it's not right. I mean, we should honor these young human beings who are compassionate when they're going into medical school and want to do the right thing to help people, and then see how they're treated. And let me tell you, after the 10 years or so of training that they get, they come out with an attitude that is understandable. It's like they've been beaten up. They are brainwashed into thinking a lot of things that are absolutely not true. They are manipulated by the pharmaceutical industry and by the research industry, by the insurance industry and the political system in this country. And a lot of it seems hopeless when we come out. We absolutely can't put up with that kind of attitude, and we should do everything we can to try and support these people. It's amazing. It's shocking. It needs to be stopped.
And you know, and what's interesting, too, is that they were talking about when they did this study about the residents not getting enough sleep and all the errors and so forth, they wanted to spend more money on doing more studies on it. It's like, why do we need studies on it? It's common sense.
Well,
anybody knows that if you're not getting enough sleep.
Well, what do you think they're trying to say? We really can't afford this because it's going to cost us billions of dollars more every year to take care of it. So, yeah, so let's put it off and let's study it some more. And in the meantime, you know, this kind of talk was going on in 1965, okay, when I first came out of my medical school training at Duke University Medical Center. And in my last year of residency, I led a strike. Okay, at my hospital.
Yeah, you weren't very popular.
No, but I led a strike that said these working conditions and the way we treat patients is inhuman, inappropriate, and it needs to be stopped more right now. And what happened? I got called in front of the house staff, okay, the senior house staff. These are all the doctors who have been gone through their training and they're out in practice. And they're telling me, Sabuto, this is not something that we appreciate or think is right. We went through it. You should be able to go through it all right.
There's the fraternity.
And we're thinking about taking you out of this residency program, at which time I was the chief resident there, and throwing you out. And at that point in time, the chief of medicine, who actually colluded with me to do this a little bit, his name was Hunter Cutting, no longer alive, stood up and said, you guys should be yourself, that you can't support these doctors in training to make their life decent so when they come out of it, they can have an attitude that's the right attitude. And they all shut up, which, of course, is what they should have done. But it's still going on today, 40-plus years later. And it needs to be stopped today. Where the hell are my colleagues at doing something about this? What are the people in these ivory towers think they're doing to continue to take advantage of these people? They're accepting money from who? The pharmaceutical industry a lot of the time, and probably other places you don't want to know about to keep their funds going, their places functional.
Because who funds these research projects?
Well, we've got to go back to a system that understands what's happening and do what's right,
not just what's convenient or what's economically feasible. It needs to be fixed. That's number one. It's about providing service. It's not about providing economics. And we need to find a way to do that rather than saying we need to do one more study. Let's do one more study to prove something that's absolutely stupid to have to prove, because it's obvious that if you overwork somebody, they're going to make more mistakes, and we're going to be on the wrong end of it. And these poor residents that are going to be whipped around like they are going to be the ones doing surgery on you, okay, if you come into a teaching hospital and they're not even going to tell you. How outrageous can it get?
I remember when we were going to get married, I was working in Providence Hospital at the time, and one of the doctors had heard that I was going to marry you, and he said, you're going to marry that troublemaker?
That's right. Well, that's okay. I'm a whistleblower because I like to tell the truth, and I've got ethics that I think are important that are first, not last. These are things that we have to stake our reputations on. When you go along just with what everybody says is the right thing to do because that's the way it's always been, and you're not thinking about it, and you're just going along with the crowd, what the hell are you doing? Need to do something about we're taking responsibility for our own health in a way that makes sense, and also making sure that the people that are being trained to take care of us have good health too. Don't you think our doctors should be people who are happy at what they do? I mean, if they were so happy, why do we have so many problems? I mean, look at what's happened in HMO medicine. I mean, the docs didn't even have brains enough 20 years ago or 25 years ago to see what was happening. And they were selling their practices to hospitals and to work for HMOs. And now what's happened is they've become employees and they can't even control what's happening. This is a very sad state of affairs in this country, and it needs to be changed.
The focus needs to be on the patient.
Well, what a thought. Yeah, but it also needs to be focused on the doctor.
Yeah.
I want my doctor to be happy.
Yeah.
I don't want them to just have a lot of money like most doctors do. I want them to actually feel good about what they're doing, not feel stressed. I don't think they should have long working hours. There should be ways to work around that.
Well, everybody's complaining that the doctors are overrushed and that they don't give them enough time and they don't feel cared for.
Well, yeah, but we've dug our own grave there. You know, you sell your practice to a hospital or an HMO, then they tell you what to do and what you can and can't do, and they set precedents out there that you're stuck with. You have no choice to change in any way.
And all you are is a number.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's true. As long as you do what they ask you to do and you're doing it enough to have a return on investment, it's going to be just fine. But until you have service as your primary thing, it's going to be about dollars. And that's what healthcare is about today. How can you spend $2.8 trillion and still have the state of affairs and health that we have today? How can you have more than 50% of us having a chronic disease? How can you have 400,000 deaths from the pharmaceutical drugs? How can you have another 600,000 deaths from other things all related to medical practice? That's like a global war. And we bring these numbers up on almost every show just to remind you that we've got huge problems that we're not taking responsibility for. We need to evolve as a culture where we provide service and we're interested in community. We need to build a relationship that's healthy with the other people that we live with, and not just at our local level, but globally and universally. These are the things that are our responsibility. And if we don't take that kind of responsibility, things are going to continue just like they are. And you're going to have to be listening to people like us and Gary Null blow their whistles and say, stop it. Think for a minute. Get it right. Find out why you're here and continue that way.
And what we think is powerful.
Absolutely. All right, enough of that rant. We're at the end of the show, or I'd rant some more. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news and health, and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 1 to 2 Eastern Time and 10 to 11 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for health will also be archived on drsaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
If you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. See you next week.